co-chair of the Methodist in Southern Africa. He is co-chair of the National Religious Leaders Forum and an executive committee member of the South Africa Conference Council of Churches. His international network includes being co-chair of the Social and International Affairs Committee of the World Methodist Council and also on the Executive Committee of the World Council of Churches. Our responder, Gillian Kingston, is known to me as the co-convener with Jeffrey Wainwright of the workshop on ecumenism and other faiths at this 12th Institute. How did she get there? Gillian is a laywoman, educated at Trinity College Dublin University. Her ecumenical involvement includes 20 years of participating in the Methodist Roman Catholic International Commission. She has served as secretary of the Joint Theological Working Party between Methodist Church and the Church of Ireland. She moderates the Church Representative Meeting of Churches Together in Britain and Ireland, and is currently president of the Irish Council of Churches. Gillian is an accredited local preacher in the church, and from the way she is managing our working group, my guess is she has been a teacher. And probably is a mother. But talk to her later. Now, if Gillian of Ireland, president of the Irish Council of Churches, and Abraham, the bishop from South Africa, team up to tell you that a different world is possible, better believe. So listen.
Amen.
Father Abraham, I give you the floor.
Thank you, Auntie Mercy, for your kind words of introduction. In Africa, an older person is either an uncle or an aunt, because we are part of a big, big family from Cape to Cairo. This morning I'm glad to be part of a larger global Wesleyan family as we gather here at Oxford. It is a singular honor and privilege and joy to make this presentation this morning. I speak as an African and a Christian of Methodist heritage who hails from South Africa. I'm very adamant that I will win space for Africa's contemporary plight, not as a beggar or apologetic, but as one who has proudly sought to remain true to a Wesleyan heritage and faithful to a theology that calls us to spread scriptural holiness throughout the land by the proclamation of an evangelical faith. Yet, as I survey the experience of poverty, pain, and disease of my country and my continent, I admit the need for transformation of our polity and practices, both as church and as citizens of the world in which we live. Ironically, the social, religious, and political institutions that silenced my ancestors are now calling me to reflect on service and on vocation. The theme of this 12th Oxford Institute constrains me to draw on the values, principles, and visions of a different world, one cruelly denied and removed from my forebears. In essence, a world in which their humanity cried out for affirmation, Yet this moment awakens in me the need to celebrate my own heritage, partially as a descendant of a resilient slave settler community, but also to commemorate the other mixture of blood from the near extinct Khoi and San tribes, blood that continues to course through my veins. I speak as one who was brought up on the Cape Flats of Cape Town, having lived in the shadow of Table Mountain. The flats is not the privileged part of Cape Town, but a territory of deep inequity, inequity of land and of resource distribution. Cape Town, that tip of Africa, still referred to by Nguni speakers as Ikoloni, the colony. The legacy of British imperialism and colonial domination is still hard to shake off, even in contemporary indigenous language, and even in democratic South Africa. Ironically, Britain commemorated 200 years of the abolition of the transatlantic slave trade on the 25th of March this year. Herbert McGonnelly argues that this anniversary should have special significance for the Wesleyan holiness people around the world, as the father of the holiness movement, John Wesley, was one of the dominant voices against slave trafficking and clearly upheld the work and motivation of the abolitionist William Wilberforce. Just as many scholars, economists, and leaders of civil society unambiguously argue that global economy and neoliberalism fuels a different form of slavery, so too would it be necessary to unpack and analyze words and phrases such as serve the present age and fulfillment of one's vocation in our context of our global village. After roughly 2.5 centuries of economic growth, following the main thinkers of the Enlightenment, who believed in the essential equality of humanity and the ability of societies in all parts of the world to share in economic prosperity, I believe that God's future lies in a different world. A world in which all can begin to flourish through respect and dignity, irrespective of race, culture, gender, language, or sexual orientation. The burning question remains unanswered, however. How do we serve the present age and fulfill our vocations when the outcome of economic globalization and neoliberalism are being defined by an ever-increasing gap between the rich and the poor, and the ongoing impoverishment of Africa and the resultant degradation of our biosphere? How do we exercise leadership from church and society when the edifices of power within the international financial institutions, such as the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the World Trade Organization, imposes policies and prescriptions that negate Africa's democratic sovereignty? I want to believe that the present age is bound up with God's future, and that our salvation, similarly linked, lies in our vocation and mission choices that promotes mutual coexistence, the flourishing of humanity, and the healing of God's world. The eschatological question then is, how will we be true, even unconsciously so, to the vision of a different world portrayed in Matthew 25, where God is at the center of our attention in work and ministry to the marginalized, the impoverished, the alienated, the diseased of our nation and of our world? Charles Villavicencio, a Methodist theologian, pointed out during a time of apartheid's entrenched national security, that Wesley's doctrine of perfect sanctification holds the key to a broader Wesleyan perspective, an acknowledgement that God's activity of social transformation includes human participation. The ultimate meaning of sanctification, says Villavicencio, is to pursue this broad theological horizon that could assist us to become co-creators and active partners with God transforming South Africa. Such was the vision of service and vocation of a different church for a different world then, and I believe it holds good for us now. Therefore, just as Pliny the Elder believed that Africa always has something new to offer, I offer this exploration of service and vocation of a different church in a different world as a vocation for justice, peace, and human equity. Some virtues that the current architects of world power appear unwilling to consider or incapable of delivering. But it is to this transforming age, the age of God's future, already present in our midst in the lives and experiences of the poor and the marginalized and the dehumanized, that this present age needs seriously to focus its mission and vocation. Because know one thing, God is to be found nowhere else. In the same way that South Africa's apartheid framework spawned systems of separate development, so it appears that global capital has privileged and continues to privilege the West and its allies against Africa and the rest of the two-thirds world. I'm of the firm conviction, therefore, that similar dynamics and much more are at work in an age that I have no hesitation as labelling global economic apartheid. The extent of this apartheid is, however, far more devastating, as you will hear me unpack how nations and continents, and especially Africa, have fallen and continue to fall into slavery as a result of the current global economic system and the rules it extracts, and have extracted for hundreds of years more than it ploughs back. Despite the political victory of Wilberforce and the Anti-Slavery Act, descendants of enslaved forebearers in the two-thirds world still experience unparalleled systems of control, domination, and disempowerment by wealthier nations. For this reason, it is safe to say that slavery has mutated into a multiplicity of structures that fetter people and keep nations in bondage today. While 200 years ago its form was the inhuman, brutal, and forced removals of people away from their lands of birth, its form in the 21st century targets those same continents in order to maintain political and economic dominance. The structures that disguise contemporary slavery may appear successful, but they continue to discriminate. George Richer puts it succinctly when he argues that despite the challenge of Methodism to remain relevant and centered in the 21st century, we are sucked into the powers that be, which are now defined by global capitalism, an economic system that marginalizes large parts of the population and where inequality is becoming more severe. He says, we witness a new system of slavery that is far more heinous and cruel than what Wesley could ever have imagined. More cruel than the European and American slave trades ever were, since people are becoming more and more commodified. The question that arises is, how did this happen? And again, I want to repeat, the answer is that slavery has mutated over the past 5 centuries. And what we call economic globalization today is simply the contemporary version of slavery. But while slavery of 200 years ago reduced humanity to a tradable commodity on the global market because of a black skin, contemporary global economic expansion makes every human being expendable, and therefore the continent of Africa becomes the most vulnerable and expendable, especially when the economy assumes a divine rationale. Patrick Bond, and I agree with him, says that Africa is to a large degree a looted continent. In a contemporary affirmation of Walter Rodney's analysis of the underdevelopment of Africa by Europe, Bond recognizes the colonial advantage of trade by force, deception, rape, theft, and pillage that define the Western world's patterns of political and economic relations with Africa. To illustrate my point on turning an African country into a slave economy, I turn to the newly defined democracy, that of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. 2 months ago, on the 29th of June this year, the DRC put together its first national budget and announced a total budget expenditure framework of $2.4 billion. This amount is equivalent to the sum spent by the United States in less than 2 weeks for the occupation of Iraq. How, under conditions devastated by two wars in which 3.5 million people died, can a nation rebuild itself with that kind of budget? By comparison, France, which, like the Democratic Republic of the Congo, has a population of around 60 million, has a budget of $520 billion. In other words, more than 200 times the Congolese budget. The subsoil of the Congo is referred to as a geological scandal, a treasure of mineral resources, and the country's agricultural land is incredibly fertile. But the International Monetary Fund believes that this is an appropriate budget, especially as its officials await debt repayment, slightly in excess of 50% of that budget. As we meet in Oxford today, it is important to acknowledge that although the slave trade was abolished in this country, in Britain, by an act of Parliament 200 years ago, human bondage, social and economic injustice still remain a major issue. Slavery and its legacies have been critical in shaping the cultural history of the modern world. We cannot escape the fact that much of Britain's wealth, many of the cities filled with cathedrals, palaces, and corporate houses, are built on an unjust system that extracted millions of Africans from their homes as chattel to supply slave labor, to supply the slave labor market. Much of what we see around us is the result of the slave trade and slave-based industries that supplied raw materials from the colonies to sustain the British Empire. Wolf Wilde says in his commentary on Mark's Gospel, before we can make poverty history, we need to understand rather more of the history of how poverty has been made. Let me repeat that. And this is the commentary on Mark's gospel, where he says, before we can make poverty history, we need to understand rather more of the history of how poverty has been made. And I ask, how is it that a biblical commentary, that is a political and historical commentary, becomes a necessary contribution to Christian social thought and practice? And I believe that the issue is that British, American, and European versions of colonization require a modicum of honesty in understanding how they underdeveloped Africa. It is, as Wilde insists, a matter of honest and faithful telling and retelling your history to your children and children's children of how your ancestors benefit from the wealth, labor, and resources of my immediate and past ancestors. The legacy of an enslaved continent is ongoing enslavement and Western economic ascendancy through international financial institutions. Let me now briefly try and put this in a global perspective by looking at globalization, economic globalization, and their discontents. Globalization is generally accepted as an ongoing process of human, political, and international development. On the whole, it effects, as they may relate to technological and scientific advances, are relatively benign and often beneficial with regard to social and political relationships. Economic globalization, on the other hand, is driven by a conglomeration of powerful nations, multinational corporations, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Trade Organization. This system, says Rogati Mashana, program executive of the World Council of Churches, has widened the gap between the rich and the poor and has increased absolute poverty in the world. Komensita Karadach, however, does not distinguish between globalization and economic globalization, because for her, the economies, ecologies, and life support systems of the global south, including Africa, of course, have suffered massive ruin, since globalization is a political project based on neoliberal ideology in order to keep the global south in bondage to the global north. It is not value-free. Of deeper concern, however, is the symbiotic link drawn by Karadach between globalization and the abuse of human rights through militarization, especially in Iraq, and the global ideology and faith relationships that cement partnerships in sustaining empire. The issue is not the claim that global capital has become the most successful economy to deal with human development in the world. There might be a grain of truth in such a claim. The problem with economic globalization lies with the manner in which it distances the wealthy from the poor and concentrates wealth in the hands of a few, while impoverishing many and rendering many more redundant, unemployed, or unemployable. But a more disconcerting problem posed by global capital expansion is its all-pervasive, religious-like dogma of principles often referred to as economic fundamentals, such as belt tightening or structural adjustment programs. This confusion of religious morality with neoliberal economics is rejected and will require further attention in this paper. The truth is that these mantra-like assertions have caused confusion and promoted economic and political advantage for the wealthy nations. Contemporary slavery is the invisible pillar of global economics. I now turn towards economics and global justice. Ulrich Duchereau, a German theologian and good friend of many of us in the ecumenical movement in Africa, has warned for some time now that the projected outcomes of a global neoliberal capitalist economy are loss of life support for future generations and death if there is no U-turn immediately or in the short-term future. Certainly, the challenge which poorer nations face is not starting the engine of the economy and approaching takeoff for economic growth. If it were that simple, the African economies would have been soaring by now. Since global economic systems are human by design, they can, need, and should be challenged and corrected for deficiencies. The deficiencies of this death-inducing economy, both realized and to be realized if it continues unfettered, Duchereau argues, is sufficient for us to take up the Kairos challenge of our faith. In an article, Political and Economic Well-being and Justice, A Global View, Duchereau raises the importance of demythologizing economics. And he argues that capitalism has to a great extent influenced people and interest groups, using the complexity of economics as an ideological veil. In the midst of the triumph of capital and the collapse of Marxist socialism in the 80s, Duchereau grappled with biblical models such as God's option for the Hebrew slaves in Egypt. Grappled models of poverty and wealth in the modern era and the use of countervailing forces against capital. For Duchereau, the ecumenical concept of responsible society was inadequate to deal with the ascendancy of capital. Justice for him, just like for Mr. Wesley, consisted of using church communities as economic alternatives, such as projects that lend money without charging interest, promoting production cooperatives on church-owned land, forming networks with countervailing forces, creating pressure from below to raise alternatives for the provision of basic needs, and enabling people's participation in economic decisions and holding in view the rights and needs of future generations. I now turn to the African concepts of justice that complements our search for economic justice, signs of a different church and a different world. And here I point to an African concept called Ubuntu Butu, an economics with a human face. Insofar as the neoliberal economic framework uses market mechanisms to apportion value to the resources and goods which enable life, says Buleng Lenkabula, it unwittingly perpetuates the hegemony of the market over and above other life-giving principles and values, such as Ubuntu, Butu. Butu, or Ubuntu, is a Sesotho word which explains personhood and humaneness, which roughly translates, says that a person is a person because of other persons. Four elements of Ubuntu are of importance in its link with the economy. Firstly, humaneness is about relationships and cooperation. A human being is shaped by cultural, genetic, historical, biological, and social relationships, not merely mechanical ones, which may allow for competitiveness and individualism. Secondly, Ubuntu is about respect and empathy for others, and indicates a worldview that is sensitive to the ecosystem, that leads to communal responsibility for the sustenance of life. Thirdly, Ubuntu is about a deep interconnectedness of life and nurture of earth as a value that links to justice and fairness in the use of the earth's resources. Fourthly, it links justice and economy, best described in an idiom that says all members of a family share the head of a locus. This Setswana proverb indicates that in a precarious economy, as for instance in times of drought, the African does not have to wait until abundance, but whatever little there is, even the head of a locus, is worth sharing. The study of Lenkabula highlights that sharing should not just be limited to individuals, but it should extend to public and private management, even that of national resources. I now turn to Wesley's evangelical economics as an alternative to economic globalization. In a biblical and a Wesleyan sense, I'm arguing that the only justice Wesleyans gathered here ought to recognize is God's justice and the justice of the poor. Wesley's concern for people on the margins of society, the poor, the sick, the imprisoned, as well as his commitment to journey downward to create a new world with the poor, on their terms and in their places, is well documented. He undertook, for instance, to distribute a considerable amount of his income to the poor and to practice what he called begging for the poor, whereby he solicited from the prosperous what the poor needed. Wesley had a holistic concern for the well-being of all God's creatures, mind, body, and soul. That was the reason for his medical clinics, his meals to the poor, interest-free loans, etc., etc. In summary, Theodore Jennings indicates that Wesley's evangelical economics addressed four main issues: the demystification of wealth, a preferential option for the poor, a protest against injustice, and stewardship as the redistribution of wealth. Suffice it is to say, however, that Wesley lived what he professed, that the gospel of Christ knows no religion but social religion, no holiness but social holiness. Some may say that this is overplayed, but to distill the Wesleyan option for the poor in an evangelical economics, let us unpack Wesley's sermon, The Use of Money, frequently dismissed as an apology for primitive capitalism. And here, Randy Maddox assists us in reminding that the injunction to gain all you can merely stated the assumption to enjoy social responsibility in the manner one acquires property, capital, or the means of production. The injunction to save relates to the manner of self-denial in the use of resources without straying into waste and the indulgence of luxury. The command to give renounces the accumulation of anything beyond one's basic needs and advises the redirection of surplus possessions to meet the needs of one's neighbor in want. This understanding of stewardship is contrary to the economics of accumulation and greed. It is the heart of Wesley's evangelical economics. For him, the criterion for every action was how was it going to benefit the poor. It is for that reason that he contended that visiting the poor was a means of grace alongside public prayer and the sacraments. Wesley's economic ethic was more than an ethic of decision or personal choice. The Wesleyan tradition of practical living, homiletics, and theological treatises portrays a model of holiness of heart and life that, as early as the age of the Enlightenment, refuses to separate the realms of life into secular and sacred, into public and private. Peter's story makes the point that Wesley made the revolutionary discovery that you could not really be a Christian unless you engage the poor of the earth. And he further defines a Wesleyan Christian as one who has made an intentional option to stand with the poor and the marginalized of society against the principalities and powers that hold all in such bondage. So far, so good. But how do we explain Methodist leadership, not only in South Africa, but elsewhere in the world, failing to come to grips with the nexus between faith and politics and faith and economics? I'm not suggesting that we take a reconstructed 18th century theological treatise and develop a 21st century reaction to the global economic malaise. What I am suggesting is that we recognize that the poor are caught in a trap of death, in a trap of despair, orchestrated by people who are supposed to be regulating global economics. And this is a life and death matter. This is a matter of faith. The very dignity of the poor is being impaired by economic globalization that marginalizes and excludes them. And just as theology undergirded the slave trade in the 18th and 19th century, as I look around and as I evaluate, much of our current theology, by omission or commission, must plead guilty of collusion with the purveyors of global capital. For this reason, it is salient to turn to Wesley's general rules, in which he prohibited the buying and selling of the bodies and souls of men, women, children, with the intention to enslave them. In Thoughts Upon Slavery, he attacked the institution of slavery by affirming the dignity and human rights of Africans. Besides appealing to the Christian conscience of those involved in the slave trade, he also cited human decency, natural law, and justice as reasons enough to abolish slavery. For Wesley, true Christianity was characterized by love of God and neighbor, and for this reason slavery was inhuman and unjust. A further telling point I've seldom heard expressed in Wesleyan theology is about the power of the stories of the struggles of an African person for freedom and dignity. And here I'm referring to the book that Wesley read on the interesting narrative of the life of Olodo Ikwenyo, that confirms for me the doctrine of Christian perfection, the means of grace, especially the overlap of works of mercy and works of piety that were vibrantly alive in the last days of Mr. Wesley's personal life. It is this identification with the struggles of the marginalized. It is this solidarity with the slaves' quest for human freedom that motivated his writing. 6 days before his death, on the 2nd of March 1792, to encourage William Wilberforce to press on in his crusade to abolish slavery in Britain and in America. Today, in this Oxford Inquiry, the injunction to serve the present age, our calling to fulfill, in the face of global capital expansion and of debt. This is one of the biggest challenges that we face this century. How do we respond to global capital expansion? And how do we respond to the debt crisis? We are reminded that it is only as we hear the cries of the vast majority of debt-ridden, impoverished humanity, and as we act in solidarity with them, especially in our understanding of the means of grace, that we have a chance to eradicate poverty and overcome its attendant forms of neo-colonial slavery. John Wesley radically influenced theology, ethics, and behavior more than 200 years ago. And this morning I pose the question, can his theologians, his preachers, his people, 2 centuries later, do the same in the face of global capital expansion and the doctrines of neoliberalism? And I want to move and very quickly towards an African and Wesleyan theology of God's economy for life and for the future. Methodism in South Africa has always wrestled with its heritage in the context, especially of apartheid, and more recently in post-apartheid democratic South Africa. Somebody who addressed this Oxford Institute a few years ago, Itumeleng Mosala, takes Charles Philip Asensio's theoretical proposal further and recommends that a Wesleyan theology of social emancipation take seriously its location amongst the poor. He therefore called for a dynamic revision of the doctrine of Christian perfection by challenging Methodism to take seriously the discourses of the struggles of the oppressed people. I suggest that this is still relevant today, and in fact lies at the heart of my presentation. Our vocation to serve the present age therefore challenges us to understand the heart of the doctrine of sanctification, Wesley's standards of excellence, Christian perfection, by which the gift of grace in Christian life is to be measured through the voices, stories, characters on the African continent and elsewhere that are seeking to redress such imbalances of wealth and power distribution. I now offer 3 African and Wesleyan reflections that may enhance our attempt at working towards alternatives to economic globalization. I hope to present very briefly a theology with human faces rather than a theology of mere intellectual engagement. My first example of a living theology is the People's Budget Campaign and the Basic Income Grant Coalition. And these examples are drawn from where I'm located in South Africa. The People's Budget Campaign was convened some 7 years ago as a joint campaign to critically engage the South African government on its budget choices and fiscal allocation. The three founding stakeholders are the Congress of South African Trade Unions, the South African Council of Churches, and the South African Non-Governmental Organization Coalition. The Church's participation is defined by the search for economic justice and a pro-poor budget that advocates government spending more and better on the social needs of the poor in order to redress the apartheid legacies of economic and social inequity. The basic income grant campaign is a sibling of the people's budget campaign and similarly advocates for poverty eradication by engaging government in the formulation of comprehensive social security policies, including a guaranteed minimum income, especially for the near 20 million South Africans who live on less than $2 a day. These campaigns are accountable to each of church, labour, and civil society constituencies in South Africa. In the vexed context of South Africa's integration into the global economy and its current guise of global capital expansion, Keith van Meulen, one of my colleagues, working within the People's Budget Campaign and the Basic Income Grant Coalition, challenges us to revisit our Wesleyan heritage. He interrogates various assumptions of neoliberal market economy, and he uses his understanding of Mr. Wesley's means of grace and salvation by faith to dialogue on behalf of communities in South Africa that still bears the legacies of apartheid's inequity. In interpreting our Methodist heritage from this underside of history, van Meulen forces us to look at some critical questions. And I'm not going to raise all the questions that van Meulen raises. Those who know van Meulen know that he's loquacious, and the more questions you ask, the more questions he presents to one. But I want to raise three. He says, if we are saved by faith, by grace through faith, to do good works, as co-creators with God, how is it possible to hand over an economic order to the invisible hand of the market forces? The second question, to what extent does and has a market economy that encourages the privatization of rights and social assistance encourage the people called Methodists to renege on the option for the poor as an integral part of Wesleyan service through the means of grace? Has the theology of the market economy not contributed to an unnatural widening of the distances already promoted between secular and sacred and public and private realms, so rigorously held together in Mr. Wesley's own life of Christian perfection? Another question, if the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, how do we accept an economic order based on scarcity and therefore inequitable distribution? How do we deal with the growing inequality between rich and poor, developed and developing nations, and with its related problems such as debt, disease, and death? And then van Meulen raises a last question. He says, can we find any biblical or theological justification for the idea that an economic order and globalization are value-free? Did Jesus not say we cannot serve two masters, God and mammon? I believe this Oxford Inquiry would do well in attempting to address some of these questions as we seek to confirm our vocations and service to the present age, interrogating the assumptions that underlie global economic expansion and neoliberalism. A further aspect for engagement would be the nature of alliance building and cooperation with other sectors of civil society, the ecumenical movement, and even organized labor, like the call for debt cancellation, advocacy, and economic reform, as espoused by the Jubilee movement. These activities are examples of how Wesleyans can make relevant Wesley's Catholic spirit. We need to extend our understanding of Mr. Wesley's parish, because the order of global economics that denies life and degrades the quality of human life is a task that Wesleyans need to engage in order to be clear about alternatives for God's economy, for life that an evangelical economics offers. Neoliberalism must not be allowed to define our vocation, nor the nature of our service to the world. A second example of a living theology is Ubuntu, salvation for the people and the market. We have already addressed the issue of Ubuntu in the context of economic justice in the face of the global market economy. Suffice it here to add that Ubuntu can be utilized to contribute to the vision of a life-affirming, just, and sustainable economy. The sense of human belonging, identity, and quality of relationships is further enhanced by Desmond Tutu when he refers to Ubuntu as the essence of being human, which embraces hospitality, caring about others, willing to go the extra mile for the sake of others. When we add to these values the quality of sharing, we may extend the depth of Wesley's Catholic spirit in recognizing and co-opting the African value and way of life as Christian and Wesleyan and vice versa. Perhaps it is the quality of Ubuntu in Mr. Wesley that has allowed Methodism to flourish on the African continent. If we accept this natural symbiosis, then we will understand Lenkabula's connection of Ubuntu economics with an African and Wesleyan quest for a sustainable global economy and God's future economy. Lenkabula argues that Ubuntu is the basis for morality, cooperation, compassion, communalism, and if embraced, it can help us work towards the ideal of a just society. Embedded in the concept of fundamental values and notions such as solidarity with the vulnerable and the marginalized, communal responsibility for the sustenance of life, and the propensity to share with the less privileged rather than wanton accumulation. Even in the midst of scarcity, hardship, and degradation that Africans experience and continue to endure, Lenkabula believes that Ubuntu has remained as a life, ethical, and social resource which African people continue to utilize for their sustenance. It is an ethic which provides a commendable schema of values to survive. And when the chips are down and the ravages of a global economy based on consumerism, greed, and the extraction of every resource for profit hits home, it will not only be the African that is degraded of human status. Human degradation, irrespective of where it comes from, will be at stake. It is then that all will recognize the salvation qualities of Ubuntu, the heart of sustenance for African resilience, has much to offer the 21st century Wesleyans and the rest of the world. Lastly, I want to look at Wesley's Catholic spirit and the Olive Agenda as an example of a living theology. In more ways than one, big business and the global economy have assumed the role of promoting a green agenda by developing a culture of supply and demand on the abundance of resources, be it fossil fuels for energy, or the supply of privatized water and or global agribusiness for food. On the one hand, the assumption is that the Earth's resources can best be exploited for the provision of human need, while such provision may also generate a surplus of cash or profit. The scientific communities and the United Nations are in agreement that this model contributes to our global warming and climate change, and it is not sustainable. I want to suggest that Wesleyans today recognize Wesley's inclusive and cooperative spirit of enhancing the dignity of humanity. For if our spiritualities and our theologies do not contribute to the enhancement of such, they are not worth the effort. The recognition of cooperation with all God's people, the household of God, the oikos meni, is integrated into the warm heart and extended hand. Integrated into these concerns would be the law of the household, the economy, the oikos nomos, based on the understanding that God is the ultimate owner and steward of the resources of the cosmos. The recognition that this household, the people of God, are called to care for creation and maintain its use for future generations is its ecology, the oikos logos. The ecumenical agenda has great benefit for taking on board what is called the Olive Agenda, defined by Steve de Grucy in his address to the South African Council of Churches National Conference this year. De Grucy proposes an Olive Agenda, where we take what he calls the brown agenda, that is working for poverty, and the green agenda with its focus on the environment, to integrate economics with ecology, peace with justice, health with prosperity, democracy with tolerance, that holds together a vision of God's economy. The household of God is called to develop poverty eradication strategies such as land provision for the poor, for sustainable livelihood, together with an agenda that explores the use of renewable energies rather than fossil fuels. This ecumenical agenda is worth exploring and would give new meaning to the Catholic spirit and the doctrine of sanctification that we seek to espouse. In conclusion, the abolition of slavery 200 years ago is something without precedent in history. But the existence of millions of enslaved people around the world as a result of economic globalization is a major scandal, but also a challenge for the church in our time. Just as the abolition of slavery was an imperative for Christians in the 18th and 19th century, so I believe we need to have the same passion, commitment, and determination of the abolitionists if we hope to end slavery in our lifetime. Many over the years have warned and spoken out against the systematic pillage, rape, and looting of Africa's resources. They've either been ignored, or in the case of Walter Rodney and others, had their lives snuffed out. Are we likely to witness the same denial and rejections of the critiques of neoliberalism? Our theological reflection need to unmask idolatry and remind us that God acts in human history through human activity. I would argue that we as Wesleyans begin to develop a mindset that challenges the assumption by economic globalization that there is no alternative. An immediate project to consider is utilizing our resources together with other like-minded civil society organizations to lobby our governments for an economics that provides for the basic necessities for the poor, the marginalized, and especially vulnerable women and children. This attempt at exploring a living theology, small and incipient as the People's Budget and Basic Income Grant campaigns, does not merely describe distant sufferings of others, but integrates faith and works and present a model worth emulating on a continental and global scale. As contemporary heirs of Wesley, we remind ourselves today that our roots are firmly planted in the doctrine of sanctification. For this reason, we were raised up to spread scriptural holiness throughout the lands. It is only as we draw on our heritage and reflect on the context in which we find ourselves and link faith to works, pietism to social action, spiritual, religion, and political engagement that a new world of justice and peace will become a reality. Friends, my life and ministry has been shaped by the enormity of God's abundant grace and salvation that have creatively ebbed and flowed through my Wesleyan and African heritage. And I'm grateful for this opportunity that has brought me to this time and this place. I'm of the firm conviction that our vocation and service to the present age is a call for transformative justice that goes beyond merely fulfilling of rights. It is a moral, ethical, theological imperative to be in solidarity with the poor, which is irrevocably bound up with discerning God's future, which calls us to be a different church for a different world. We live in an age that is pregnant with hope, where a new world is waiting to be born. Our calling is to work together with all humanity, to work together with God, to shape a different future. I thank you.